You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher.
Rap genius.
The way you prove your manhood is by compulsively dominating someone else. It doesn't always have to be the same person, but that's what gives you power.
Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. This week, we have a conversation with author Michael P. Jeffries. Jeffries' latest book is Paint the White House Black, Barack Obama and the Meaning of Race in America. The book provides a well-thought-out but fascinating breakdown of attitudes towards race and racism in America. Jeffries is a professor at Wellesley College and also, as you'll hear, quite a hip-hop head. He wrote extensively about hip-hop music and culture for The Atlantic and The Guardian. We talked to Jeffries at our Rap Genius office in Brooklyn. As always on Outside the Lines, we bring you annotated interview excerpts. Every time you hear this sound,
Rap Genius,
go to rapgenius.com and search for OTL42. From there, you'll find excerpts that bring you audio, video, and more information to get you further outside the lines. And now, here's our talk with Michael P. Jeffries. Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. Your host, Same Old Sean, here with the author Michael P. Jeffries.
Hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
For our listeners who might not know you, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your work?
Yeah, I'm a professor at Wellesley College, and a lot of my early work was about rap music and hip-hop, and my most recent work has sort of turned toward Barack Obama and race, and I'm not really interested in telling people about Obama's biography or analyzing every single policy move he makes.
Presumably, I mean, there's armies of people devoted to that, right?
So. Exactly. I'm more interested in talking about him as a cultural symbol and figuring out what we can learn about race from the way we deal with Obama as kind of a society.
Okay. And, you know, what we can learn presumably is in your book, so I'm not going to ask you for a capsule answer, but I was reading through an excerpt of it on Rap Genius. And I saw this concept that really tied in a lot of ways to ways I think about race and the public conversation about racism that have been encapsulated in three neat words, and I was hoping you could talk about it. And it was racism without racists.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you could talk about that.
This is a great idea, and that phrase actually comes from the work of Eduardo Bonilla Silva, who's a professor at Duke. And the basic idea is that we live in this age where it's no longer okay to just admit that you dislike people of color or to say offensive things. So individual racists seem to have vanished from our consciousness, from our society. But racism as a system that limits people's choices and privileges some people while penalizing others in different ways and influences the way we see people in our day-to-day lives, racism still exists. So we have this strange situation where we're trying to deal with and talk about and dismantle racism without targeting individual racists.
Rap
genius. Right, and there's in your book you talk about this idea of a sports commentator calling a player, was it an angry monkey
or right.
something, and going into sort of the history of that phrase, and it really got for me a related concept, which is this idea of intent, and intent. When someone slips up, in quotes, and says something racist, usually their answer is,
I didn't intend to be racist. I'm not in my heart of hearts a racist. And you say that doesn't really matter all that much.
Right. I mean, the idea that you can figure out whether racism matters or whether racism exists or whether racism is at play simply by looking at an individual person's intent, that's an idea that we have to do away with. It just doesn't work anymore. So the example in the book is about Billy Packer, who's a college basketball analyst, and he, in a complimentary way, refers to Allen Iverson as a monkey. A firestorm starts, people rush to his defense, including John Thompson, who's a black basketball coach, and everyone says Packer doesn't have a racist bone in his body. But when you look at the way that black folks have been depicted in all sorts of pop cultural outlets, from the early King Kong films to the most recent cover of Vogue magazine with LeBron James and Gisele Bündchen on it, there are these strong overtones of equating black folks with apes. And this is the sort of caricature and stereotype and racist imagery that gets attached to both working class black folk and even people like Obama. Mm-hmm. So to say that race has nothing to do with Packer's comment is to ignore all the documented history that we have about how race influences the images that we associate with different kinds of people and the words that slip out of our mouths.
Right, and you say particularly that it's an example of white privilege in action for him to even be able to say, I didn't mean it, that wasn't my intent, and have people take them seriously.
That's right. And the idea of white privilege is kind of a tricky idea, right? Because on one hand, it refers to just when you're mistreating someone or treating them badly, and you gain an advantage because of your race, because you're white. But really, white privilege is also about the presumption of innocence. The notion that someone like Packer can start with a clean slate, can be presumed innocent for all of his actions, all the things that he says, the things that he does. That benefit of the doubt is so rarely granted to people of color. Mm-hmm.
That's incredible. And so I wanted to talk about something also. You mentioned in you talk about, you know, Tupac and the idea of a thug and the history of thug throughout his career. And you say that his adoption of a thug identity and what thug meant to him was kind of all over the place.
Yeah, it really was. I think that one of the things that trips people up when they talk about Tupac is they want to trace his career as a straight line with a very clear trajectory, a starting point, evolution, and ending point. And that's not the way the history of Tupac actually works. He jumps around and goes back and forth, and he certainly starts with a more kind of politically conscious persona and moves in the direction of a more commercially conscious persona as his career evolves and his popularity increases. But he never totally rejects the political consciousness that he had at the beginning. So all of this to say, when he first comes out with the idea of the thug, it's the acronym that this hate you gave. He's talking about people who have been left behind, people who have been discounted and disparaged because of their race. And the more he uses it, it becomes sort of a sexy word, a word that connotes partying, a word that connotes power, a word that connotes not just a fuck-the-world mentality, but something that's attractive in a pop-cultural sense.
Right, thugging becomes a verb.
Exactly.
It can mean almost anything.
It can mean just about anything. Whereas when he first starts talking about it, it meant something specific, right? It was referring to a specific population of people who had been mistreated and counted out.
Right. As opposed to, you know, I know in one of your essays you talk about R. Kelly and how he uses it to mean, you know, loving and or a night out with my friends or whatever.
Yeah, the song I always think of, I don't want to date myself as a hip-hop head, is that We Thuggin' song by R. Kelly and Fat Joe.
Right.
And you watch the video for that song, Fat Joe is jumping in the pool with a blue mink on. I mean, that's not a classic thuggin' activity,
right,
but that's what it became the more and more it got used.
Yeah. And a sort of modern-day interpretation of the thug that you talk about a little bit sometimes is this idea that, like, there's this new dichotomy in hip-hop now where you have the good guys who are, like, you know, the smart, sensitive rappers who aren't afraid to show emotion, and then the thug rappers who are bad either because they are, you know, bad for the community or, you know, limiting blackness or only concerned about commercial success or whatever. And there's two very distinct categories, you know, the you know, Kanye's and the Rick Ross's, to throw out names fairly randomly. And you're pretty against that dichotomy, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't think it works as well as we would like to think it does. I'm similarly suspicious of the conscious versus commercial distinction. Right. I think that's another dichotomy that maybe we can pull apart. But that's a debate for the listeners to have, right? I mean, maybe for some people, they really do categorize people that way. But the trouble I have is that if you ever take the time to consider an artist's full catalog, you know, read every line, listen to every track on the album, you can find contradictions and hypocrisies and the different faces and masks that we all wear. The artists are doing the same thing. And it's tricky for them because they're under a great deal of pressure, the commercially successful ones, to build an image that's readily consumable, right? You know you want Cheerios, so you go buy Cheerios. You know you want a thug rapper, so you go buy Rich Boy or Rick Ross or whatever it might be. But it never ends up tasting exactly the way you think the Cheerios are going to taste. When you taste every single Cheerio in the box, you're going to get a little that are kind of funky. And I think that even though we try to put people in boxes, it doesn't quite work as well as we'd like to think it would.
Awesome. You wrote this essay that ties into something I've thought and worried a lot about. It was the one you did about Southern rap. For folks who haven't read it, the idea was basically Southern rap used to mean a multiplicity of things. What was happening in, you know, Florida, what was happening in Atlanta, what was happening in Port Arthur, Texas, what was happening in Houston, Texas, and so on and so on. And you talk about the South now being more of a monolith.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's hard for me to say because I'm someone that's never lived there. So on one hand, I don't have a great deal of life experience below the Mason-Dixon line, so I can't say, you know, if the South exists. But when I hear it being represented in rap music, my concern is that the word the South has kind of replaced or drowned out all the little individual references that used to make Southern rap so distinct, that used to make Southern rap sound so distinct. So you know the organized noise sound that came out of Atlanta, right? And you know that that's something different than the Timbaland and Missy sound that came out of Virginia. And when those groups of people were making music, they weren't calling themselves Southern rappers. They were just defining their sound, and it had these very specific references that you might only know if you were from the places they were from. But now you get people like Crit who are mixing and matching, which I think is a productive artistic move, some of the different musical cultures, mixes some Mississippi stuff with some Texas stuff, for instance. That's something that comes up a lot in Crit's music. But the references seem to be really generic references like the cars and the food. They almost seem to be stereotypes or caricatures of what you would think the South was about instead of the actual lived experience of being from Crit's neighborhood in Mississippi.
Okay. Do you think that maybe this idea of local styles is kind of dying out in a way?
I don't think it's dying out in real life. They're still there just as much as they ever were. But when you have to, when there's pressure to elevate them to prominence and reproduce them and sell them, you're looking for as many access points as you can possibly come up with so that someone doesn't need to feel the precise connection to buy that thing. Something that seems vaguely familiar, something that's easy to identify with. To me, I think that many people think that's a more saleable product, and that's maybe why it's happening more than it used to.
Okay. I wanted to take a different tack for a second. Right before we came in here, we were looking at an essay you'd written about Angel Hayes and about her cleaning out my closet freestyle. And you talked about that as a sort of watershed moment in terms of hip-hop and its more open talk about rape and rape culture, which is a term that's gained some currency lately. I was curious to hear your thoughts about the Rick Ross incident, another thing that caused the term rape culture to be used in the popular discussion more than it had in any time in my recent memory.
Yeah, I mean, the activists who have been working and trying to get us to understand not only the seriousness of rape, but to understand that the way we talk about rape is important, that we need to be honest about it, that we need to be kind of unforgiving with the language. It's important to understand there are grassroots people who have been fighting this battle for a long, long time. And the fact that it's now popping up around conversations that have to do with music is a tribute to their hard work. But with results, with reference to this most recent event with Ross, I think one of the things that you're seeing now that's encouraging is that the apology, whether it's a half-assed apology or a genuine apology, the apology is insufficient now. This is an important step because folks who are upset about these kinds of portrayals and the way that rape is treated as something that's ordinary and the rate at which victims are blamed, that's no longer acceptable. And apologizing for it is no longer acceptable. We're moving from apology to a culture of accountability and revolution. And that's what the anger is about. The anger isn't they want Ross to say he's sorry. The anger is they want accountability at all levels of the music industry and the other industries that we dabble in.
Yeah, it was interesting, especially with him, because his first round of apologies were, in a lot of ways, severely lacking. They didn't seem to understand the import of what he did, and it wasn't until the very end of the process that he released a statement that that at all had any kind of accountability, like you were talking about.
Yeah.
And even then, it had a line that I thought was sort of throwing, struck me as very suspicious, where he talked about at least it started a conversation or was happy to have started a conversation or something.
Right. That conversation's been happening. That's the point. The starting a conversation, the being thoughtful about it, that's not really what we need to do now.
Those phrases should be more or less outlawed.
Exactly. We need to make people, hold people accountable and change the rules that allow these things to be considered ordinary for good.
Yeah, and speaking of things that are ordinary but maybe shouldn't be, you've written a bit about the construction of femininity in hip-hop, and that hip-hop has its own special version and twist on, you know, the sort of virgin-whore dichotomy that often women are put in a position where they have to be one or the other, but you say hip-hop has its own kind of special twist on that.
Yeah, so there's a, you know, the virgin-whore dichotomy, you can see it in all kinds of popular culture. I mean, and, you know, it's fascinating because you can see it working itself out in the careers of very famous pop stars where all of a sudden, whether it's Britney Spears or Christina Aguilera or someone like that, there's pressure to begin as this kind of pure version, the virgin version of kind of femininity, and then mature, quote unquote, into this sexually powerful person who also sometimes gets represented in very troubling ways as a whore, right? So it's not just a hip-hop problem.
And maturing in exactly the same way for every star.
Exactly. You know,
maturing means the same thing for every person.
Because they don't have control over their career so much of the time, right? They're being managed by, and they're having their songs written by, men who are trying to sell records to demographics that they kind of come up with in their head. So, but in hip-hop, there's a bit of a difference where, you know, you have this, the story twists a little bit because you're looking for a sexually powerful woman who's also a down-ass chick, right? Someone who demonstrates her loyalty to her man through all sorts of things, right? It's often represented as some kind of partner in crime, whether real or imagined crime. So even though the virgin whore thing is still kind of playing out, there does seem to be room for different kinds of negotiations in femininity and rap than maybe in some of the other musics.
Okay. Very, very, very cool. I think one of the things you've talked about, you know, dealing with hip-hop in general is this idea that if you're in a situation where you are, you know, in the eyes of the society, non-optimal in some way, whether because of your color or your economic situation or whatever, a way of asserting for men, and in this case black men, your masculinity, is to sort of go down the food chain, right? And to demonstrate your mastery over, you know, women, over homosexuals, over people the culture kind of deems to be lesser. And you have a lot of interesting examples of that, including even Drake, who, you know, people wouldn't think of as a specifically, you know, masculine in the sort of shoot 'em up, bang bang way rapper, but he has to assert his masculinity in other ways.
Right. And we're talking about, you know, the specific form of masculinity is, it's a domination-driven masculinity, right? What that means is that the way you prove your manhood is by compulsively dominating someone else. It doesn't always have to be the same person, but that's what gives you power. It's not attribution of status based purely on a bank account or the way you look or some other kind of extrinsic quality. It's via the performance of domination. So someone like Drake, who doesn't necessarily check all the boxes for the typical hyper-masculine performer because he makes himself vulnerable in a lot of his raps about relationships, his family history. The vulnerability is there, but the ethic of I have to dominate someone in my raps still pops up. So he ends up disparaging people who don't get enough girls by calling them pussies in his song, right? Even though we know he has a vulnerable side and he thinks different things about women than many of the most popular rappers do, he still kind of slips up and plays by those rules of domination. So what we have to be looking for both men and women in hip-hop, is people who are able to assert their power without getting power from putting somebody else down. Mm-hmm.
Wow. I mean, are there models you see of how to do that successfully?
I mean, I think there are some rappers who do it quite well at some times, and then they slip up. I mean, so one of the classic figures in this respect is somebody like Common, who asserts himself as a powerful MC in all kinds of ways by virtue of his lyrical skill and his talent. His stage presence is amazing. I remember seeing Common when I was younger, and he's a huge dude. And he really controls the room without making you feel small. Mm-hmm. That's a really important talent for a performer to have, I think. But he also slips into some of those domination tropes. Mm-hmm. One of the people that's performing now who I think is able to avoid that kind of talk almost entirely is Blue. I think he does a fantastic job of gathering people's respect, forcing people to respect him as an artist and as a human being, without taking shots at people, without putting others down. He's an amazing performer, I think.
Cool. And I think something that is a bit off, but related to that, in a lot of your analysis, whether it be of, politics and issues around Obama and racial perceptions or music, you try to bring what is to a lot of people a dry academic term and bring it to life and try to sort of make your audience aware of its importance, and that's intersectionality.
Yeah, the word intersectionality is one of those words that just, it feels terrible coming out of your mouth. There are too many syllables, it's cumbersome, it embodies, all of the reasons that many academics have a hard time communicating with people outside of the classroom or outside of the university. But I think it's important for those of us who work in the academy to give the audience some credit. Like, people who read our work are not just the folks sitting in class, and smart audiences exist outside of colleges and universities. So if you have faith that once you explain something to them, they won't find it as difficult and disgusting to say, that faith is something that you should act on. And the word intersectionality is a perfect example of this. It's a messy word, but it means something that I think audiences can get very intuitively. And it's the simple principle that whenever you're thinking about race, you have to be thinking about it in combination with something else, with some other social force, like class or gender. And that's the only way to really understand how race works and why race remains so powerful, because it's working in collaboration with these other ideas.
Rap Genius.
Back to stuff about race and about, your work about Obama deals primarily with multiracial people and the way they're perceived and the concept of being multiracial. You talk about the 2000 census. Can you tell our audience maybe why that was so important, what changed there?
Right. Well, there's the 2000 census, the Mark One or More census.
Yes.
Right? And it's the first time that people are able to check more than one box. And there's kind of all of this fear when these categories are being constructed about checking more than one box as something that's going to depress the count of non-whites in the country. And depressing the count is important because The census is there so that we can try to measure things like discrimination in a quantitative way using numbers. So those political fears are driven by real fears about what will happen in terms of ignoring discrimination. But what I talk about in the book is that even among people who see themselves that way, it's not a rejection of their experiences of people of color, nor is it a denial of the fact that racism exists. So a lot of the nervousness that communities of color have around people who define themselves as mixed races, they see mixed race folk as people who are distancing themselves from the original community of color. Mm-hmm. But what I found in reading, in talking to these people for the book is they still find themselves very much connected and identified with not only the experiences of people in color, of people of color, but the fact of racism as a general fact that we need to work against.
Okay. So one thing you mentioned is who really led the charge for the mark more than one. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So during that movement for the initial category to get added, the more than one option to be added, and there's a great book by a woman named Kim Williams that talks about this in great detail. Many of the people who were at the forefront of that movement were parents of children who were the product of a mixed race union. And more specifically, the people at the very forefront of the movement turned out to be white mothers of non-white kids who felt that their children's rights were being violated by not giving them the option to check more than one race. So that adds a whole other layer of complexity, right, where it's almost as if a group is being advocated for before it really exists, right? In the process of advocating for a new set of categories, the new categories kind of come into being. And that's one of the really unique things about this kind of multiracial moment in the early 21st century.
Wow. And one of the worries that you talked about was one of the interesting sort of subtexts to all this is the fact that by and large the African American community is, and for a lot of not entirely pleasant reasons, is a largely multiracial one.
Right.
And so that this idea of like, okay, well, we're only going to let sort of first generation multiracial people claim this heritage is interesting.
Yeah, it's really difficult to navigate for all kinds of reasons, right? I mean, the first part is that this piece you mentioned, it seems sort of arbitrary to say that we're going to limit it to this current generation of folks when you're talking about Black American experiences and Black American heritage. The second piece of this is that multiracial experiences for Black folks might be quite different from multiracial experiences for Asian folks. And in particular, people who identify as both mixed race and Black may be treated as a Black person first, foremost, and primarily at a rate that is far more frequent or common than other people who have mixed race heritage, but the non-white race is Asian, or the non-white race is, or ethnicity is Hispanic.
Right. Well, there's a word for that, right?
Hypo descent, yeah. Right? But we don't have to get into one of these, right? But the point is that these experiences are going to be different, right? The experience of a multiracial person who identifies sometimes as Black is going to be different from the experiences of a multiracial person who identifies sometimes as Asian. And therefore, the category of multiracial has to be broad when you're talking about what it can actually mean. And you have to allow for people to choose it when it suits them, and at other times, leave it on the side. We can't insist that be the only category that people choose all the time, because that's not the way it works when you're going outside and interacting with people in your life.
Okay, excellent. And just sort of winding down a little bit, you had a few years ago, right as, to get back to hip-hop for a second, right as Lil Wayne was getting out of jail, you wrote a piece wondering how it would affect him, how his time in Rikers would affect him, and comparing it to, well, it did this or that to, you know, these other performers. Looking back on it from a few years' distance now, what did happen?
Yeah, I mean, It's hard because we don't know the exact details of what's going on with Wayne's life, his current chemical composition, right? We're not doctors. We can't figure that stuff out. So I don't really want to speculate on exactly what took place in the recent events.
Of course.
But the driving argument that I make in the article and that I think remains relevant in these most recent series of events is you've got to be able to pick a direction for your career when you're a rap artist, because being a performer as a rapper is just not something that's going to last forever. Jay-Z is an incredible exception to this rule, where he seems to be able to perform, you know, into his 40s, into his 50s, etc. But in particular, if the thing you're selling is your own self-destructive capacity, and that's what Wayne is selling a lot of the time, by definition, you can't continue to destroy yourself forever, because eventually the self is no more. And we're starting to see some warning signs about how unsustainable that kind of life is. Mm-hmm. And so as he's moved in the direction of becoming an executive, and he's talked about retiring at different points in time, he's got to figure out a way to make that happen without always reaching back to the controversial, self-destructive piece as part of his brand. Mm-hmm. Because that piece can't do anything else for him at this point. It's already served whatever commercial purpose it's going to serve.
Sure, made him one of the biggest stars in the country.
Exactly. Yeah. And for him to keep reaching back, he's only going to injure himself, both in the physical sense and, I think, in the branding sense. It's not sustainable anymore.
Yeah, it's so interesting with him, because at his, what I view as his artistic height, the kind of like 05 to 08, you know, mixtape period.
Dedication
for a better
term.
Yeah, exactly. Dedication to Drought 3, all this stuff. It's like part of the appeal of him was that he sounded like he was on a balance beam and could fall off at any second, even artistically, that he was just kind of like saying stuff as it came into his head. I don't know whether this was the case or not, of course, but that's what it sounded like. And, you know, about 80% of the time it would work, and sometimes it would fail miserably.
Yeah.
And it was just such a fascinating ride, and I think it ties in some ways to what you were talking about his persona and behavior.
Yeah, it was an immensely productive period for him also. I mean, he was just flooding the market with material. Not all of it was great, but he was able to reach incredible heights. And you could hear the desperation. I mean, you could hear the desperation in his voice and in the rate at which he was churning stuff out. And nobody can work like that forever, no matter what kind of industry you're in or life you're leading. We can't keep that up. We're not built for that. So I think keeping those transitions in mind and planning for the future is going to be important for Wayne and all of the other artists who are going to try to copy his business model.
And finally, you know, obviously you wrote a book about Obama and his perceptions and sort of how the public views him. He's one of the things, unfortunately, we're talking now just a few days after the Boston incident. One of the things he's had to do recently, unfortunately, something presidents sometimes have to do, which is kind of be the national parent figure.
Yeah.
And I was wondering how you thought he is being perceived. Is he sort of being successful and being seen as sort of presidential enough with given his you know, race and people's attitudes towards it?
Yeah, I mean, I think he has a remarkable talent for bringing people together at an emotional level, allowing himself to show emotion while taking on very serious and delicate topics. He's cried during multiple speeches that he's given. And I think he's handled himself in the performative moments right after these kinds of tragedies, after Newton, after the marathon. I guess I haven't seen the speech yet, but he seems to be able to do that really well. But on the other hand, we're seeing the limitations of the political process. Because even after a trauma like Newton, when there was a great public demand for legislative change, if you look at the public opinion data after the Newton tragedy, we haven't been able to realize that change in a legislative sense, right? There have been no new substantive laws passed at the federal level to deal with the gun violence issue. So people who perceive him as successful or unsuccessful at these individual points in time are also looking not only at how he did when he was giving the speech, but substantively what changed in terms of policy. And judging a president is always tough, because you have to acknowledge that he's working within institutional constraints. He's not all three branches of the government. He's only one. Mm-hmm. And that's a challenge that he has to navigate, both politically within his own circles and politically in these public performances when he goes on TV and tries to dry some of our tears.
Well, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for stopping by. What else are you working on now? What should be aware for?
I'm poking around a few different things, but I just finished an essay about Jay-Z and Obama, where I talk about the way they kind of appeal to different audiences and code switch and use different kinds of language in their political discussions. So that's the one I'm most excited about. And then a couple other things bubbling up beneath the surface. But
excellent. Well, we hope to see some of those things on Rap Genius. And thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
That was our chat with Michael P. Jeffries. If you enjoyed what you heard, make sure to find us on Facebook at Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. And follow us on Twitter at @OTL_podcast. You can also find and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. While you're there, make sure to give us a review. The more positive reviews we get, the better chance we have of continuing to get amazing guests like Michael P. Jeffries. Outside the Lines is created and written by Sean Sitaro, a.k.a. Same Old Sean.
This sexually powerful person who also sometimes gets represented in very troubling ways.
This podcast was engineered and produced by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
And we're starting to see some warning signs about how unsustainable that kind of life is.
Our music is by Psionic.
Something that seems vaguely familiar. Something that's easy to identify with.
And the creator of the soon-to-happen, I swear, OutsideTheLinesPodcast.com is Paul Dice.
They're under a great deal of pressure, the commercially successful ones, to build an image that's readily consumable.
Join us in 2 weeks on the next episode of Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, where we talk to the original head of publicity at Def Jam Records, Bill Adler. In addition to being hip-hop's premier archivist and historian, Adler also had a front-row seat to the rise of Def Jam. He was there from its very beginnings through its rise as a mega record company with artists such as LL Cool J and Public Enemy. So make sure to join us, and we'll see you in 2 weeks outside the lines.
I should mention before we start, I still haven't heard Accidental Racist by LL Cool J.
Oh, you haven't?
So if that was one of your...
That actually was not, but it. I was going to ask about something else controversial.
Just, you know, it exploded on my Twitter feed, and yeah. I was just at a point where, you know, I can't...
Right. Can't actually hear the thing. Just yet. Yeah, totally.